New life-extending medical technology and medicine have also extended the length of time people spend in a downward spiral as they face death. Journalist Stephen Kiernan says the medical system isn't adequately addressing how dying has changed. Kiernan is the author of the new book, Last Rites, that's R-I-G-H-T-S, Rescuing the End of Life from the Medical System. Kiernan wrote for the Burlington Free Press for 14 years as a columnist, editorial writer, and investigative reporter. He received the George Polk Award for Medical Reporting. Stephen Kiernan, welcome to Fresh Air. You write in your book that death used to be sudden. Now it's often gradual. How have the leading causes of death changed, and how has that changed what the end of life is like?
Well, 30 years ago, Terry, the leading causes were all sudden: heart attacks, strokes, accidents. And there was a mobilization, really, all across society. Everything from millions of people taking CPR to airbags in cars to E911 service. And those measures, as well as many medical advances, have been enormously successful. Many, many fewer people die of heart attacks and strokes and accidents. But we're all still mortal. And what happens now is that our lives end slowly of things like Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's, Lou Gehrig's disease. AIDS is a leading killer of young adults, and the granddaddy is cancer. Now people's lives end slowly, and that presents really an unprecedented opportunity for people to shape the meaning and content of the last chapter of their lives.
Well, the hospice movement has grown a lot in the past few years, but there are certain trade-offs you have to make if you want Medicare to pay for hospice. What are some of those trade-offs?
Well, there are numerous, and there the two that come to mind that are most difficult are these. A physician has to certify in order for a patient to qualify for Medicare reimbursement for hospice, has to certify that that patient will not be alive in 6 months. Well, one of the problems with that is that doctors aren't trained to know how close someone is to the end of their life, so they're notoriously bad at predicting. The other is that patients and families hear that a doctor is referring them to hospice and they think, oh, the doctor's giving up on me. One more time that the healthcare system is abandoning patients, when in fact moving into hospice is kind of the opposite experience. The other major obstacle is for a person to qualify for hospice care, they have to stop life-prolonging therapies that might have a curative effect. The classic example is a person who's got an organ failure that requires dialysis. Well, they have to choose between going into hospice and receiving dialysis. It's really no choice at all, because if you stop dialysis, you'll be dead in a matter of days, if not weeks. So the result is that there are obstacles built into the qualification for hospice that really scare folks away.
What are some of the more interesting proposals you've heard made about how to reform the guidelines for hospice eligibility?
Well, the first thing is to get rid of the either-or proposition. That is, stop dialysis to receive hospice care or turn down hospice so you can continue your dialysis. The second thing is to take a hard look at the six-month requirement, because there's so much evidence that it doesn't make sense, that it's arbitrary. You know, the third thing would be to take a look and measure the quality of hospice care and contrast it with the quality of the intensive care unit model. But the larger question is, how willing are we to look at how the end of life has changed now and be educated by what we see?
A lot of people don't die in hospice, and they don't die at home. They die in a hospital. What are some of the more interesting changes you've heard suggested for how hospitals could be dealing with the end of life?
Excellent question, Terry, because there's really some cause for optimism there in an idea known as palliative care. Palliative care is a branch of medicine that really is focused on the patient's comfort rather than curing. It's not to say that other medical teams might not continue to work on the cure, but these folks are really concentrating on such questions as, is this patient in pain? Is this patient anxious? Is this patient able to breathe? And then even some of the emotional and psychological components. Does this patient have some relationships that he or she would like to mend in the time that the patient has left? And so that is beginning to look at the patient as more of a person, not just a set of medical problems to be solved. there's been a lot of money put into educating people about palliative care and expanding it. And there have been some hospitals, about a fifth of the hospitals in the country now offer palliative care. And as I say, they are improving, almost taking the hospice model or elements of the hospice model into the four walls of the hospital.
You use as an example of the end of life, your parents' deaths. And you start with your father, who died at the age, I think, of 68 after having an aneurysm.
Actually, he was 65.
65, thank you. And you say your family kept demanding more care, more interventions, more heroic measures. What are some of the things you really wanted your father to have after he had the aneurysm?
Oh, let me draw a contrast for you, Terry. When he first had the surgery, his breathing tube was inserted in his mouth. And after a span of 5 or 6 days, his lips were split and cracked and his tongue was swollen and very white and sore and dry, so much so that my mother was actually standing by his bed, dipping her pinky in a glass of ginger ale and swabbing the inside of his mouth because it was so dry. So they decided to do a tracheotomy, in which there's an incision in the neck and the breathing tube is put in there, and then they put some ointment on his mouth. And at the time, we considered this progress. There was never a time that we stepped back and said, what's going on? What is this machine doing? What are the ethics of this machine? What is the purpose of this? What is the prognosis here? We didn't ask any of those questions. It makes me very sad to think about what we did to him with all of the best intentions.
How do you think you would have handled it differently today?
Well, I know how we handled it differently, because 4 years later, my mother was faced with an aggressive small cell breast cancer that spread all over her, and we knew enough to concentrate on different things. And it's not to say that we didn't exert a lot of medicine on her behalf. We did. But there were also limits to that. She was offered a surgery, for example, that a very renowned physician said was her only hope at a cure. It was called a hemiquadrantectomy. And Terry, what they do is this incision starts just below your ear and comes down to the center of your throat and down the center of your chest and then back under your arm. And everything outside of that incision is removed. And, you know, she was never going to button a shirt again or, you know, I mean, an incredibly disfiguring, disabling surgery. And when that was presented to us as her only hope for a cure, you know, she patted the doctor on the hand and said, thanks very much. And she went home and went Christmas shopping, even though it was September, and began to make preparations for a different path that enabled us all to be around with her. She died in her bed, with family at her bedside, her prayer book in her hand, her pain managed. It couldn't have been more peaceful.
Well, a lot of people do have DNRs, do not resuscitate orders, which basically says if they're going to die, don't go through extreme life-saving measures like a ventilator or a feeding tube, you know, if death is looking inevitable. Do you think that those aren't handled well enough, or that not enough people have them? Are they respected once you have one?
Boy, there's a lot of layers to that. Terry, DNRs in particular are respected, and the reason they are is that it's not something that the patient demands. It's an order that a physician signs into the patient's chart, and it's usually marked on the door at the foot of the bed so that people know if the patient's heart stops, that the medical team will not do all they can to resuscitate them. And that's really, you know, not end-of-life care. For a person with a DNR, it means their heart has stopped, their life has ceased. And so it's really about, are we going to try and bring them back, and what kind of measures are we going to take to bring them back? There was a almost hilarious piece of research that was done on this where the researchers watched a year worth of seasons of the main television programs that are about hospitals, and you could name them all, I'm sure. And they found that 67% of the people whose heart stopped recovered miraculously. They got that jolt on the chest, and they got a little adrenaline in their bloodstream, and, you know, 32 minutes later at the end of the program, they're up and headed home. The reality is about 1% of the people who have those extreme measures survive them. And about half of that 1%, the brain damage is so acute that they never really regain any kind of function at all. Now, if you sit down with somebody and say, this is an illness that could lead to your heart stopping, and we could do this procedure, and if you want us to, we will, and we will do our utmost to bring you back when your heart is stopped. But you should know that only about 0.5% is actually going to recover and have any kind of function. Most people, I think, would say, don't do that to me. When I'm gone, let me be gone. It will be a sad occasion, but that day is going to come someday anyway. Let me be gone. So I think there's some education, and if the education necessary, and if the education happens, then the consumers will make very intelligent choices.
The baby boom is about to create a real bulge in the population of the aging, and that's going to have a lot of healthcare consequences. I'm wondering if you've thought about ways in which you think the baby boom generation might end up consciously or inadvertently changing end-of-life care.
Well, I think that they're learning right now. You know, I learned a little earlier than most because my parents died a little younger than most. But I have many friends who are experiencing this with one or both of their parents right now. And they're learning, and what they're finding is that there's a lot to learn. So, you know, I think that when way before their own time comes, they're going to see by watching what their parents go through. I will tell you that I have a very clear idea about what I want for end-of-life care as a result of my parents' experiences and the huge gap between the quality of one and the other. And one of the things I'll be damned if I will inflict on my sons the kind of dilemmas that were inflicted upon us. You know, we had 7 children in the family and my mother trying to decide whether or not to cease my father's dialysis. That's 8 people, each with a different relationship with a patient, each with a different relationship with the health system and science, each with a different relationship with God and with the idea of the afterlife. And we're supposed to reach some kind of consensus. I won't do that to my sons. I've got very clear instructions so that they are absolved from that kind of ethical dilemma, because there is no right answer when you're in that kind of situation.
Now, you said you want to spare your sons the kind of difficult decisions that your family had to make about your father. So what else is in your medical directive?
Mine is, I think, one of the realities that was impressed on me in the course of this research and spending so much time with people whose lives were ending and their families was that I came to accept the fact that I will indeed die. And obviously it's self-evident, but I actually thought about it. And the more I thought about it, the more I thought about how I could protect my sons and my siblings. So I have very specific instructions. I can be kept alive up to 48 hours so that my sons, by any means necessary, so that my sons can say goodbye, and any of my siblings who care to. And then I want everything turned off and I want to be put in the sun. And I joke with my brother, who has the authority to make these decisions, that if that doesn't work after a little while, he can put a pillow over my head and it's all right.
That's not really in the document, though, is it?
No, that was just in our conversation. But, you know, it actually brings up a serious point, which is that when you put somebody else in charge, then you want to have a conversation with them.
After having, written this book and after having watched the death of both of your parents, do you have a different sense of what it means to keep somebody alive, you know, to have the priority being just do what you need to do to keep them alive for as long as they can be alive?
Well, I think my sense of it is confusion, Terry, that keeping someone alive under any means necessary can be a substitute for looking at reality and doing the most caring thing, which might be not another surgery. It might be a bowl of ice cream. It might be some pain medication. It might be bringing in a person that the patient had conflict with so that they can reconcile. And those opportunities can be so meaningful and rewarding that compared with the passivity of let's have another surgery and we'll cross our fingers and we'll hope for a miracle, Well, you know, miracles do happen, I suppose. But mortality happens too. We're all going to go someday. Sometimes it makes sense to flex every medical muscle, and sometimes the best thing you can do is sit by somebody's side and hold their hand and stay there, and just stay there, and that's what's really needed. That takes a certain kind of compassion and a kind of love and an opportunity for love that is quite new.
Stephen Kiernan is the author of the new book, Last Rites, Rescuing the End of Life from the Medical System.